Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Later this hour, we'll learn about the Vermont High School Writing Contest. And during the 10 o'clock hour, we're going to discuss the Harwood Unified Union School District's proposed $60 million bond for the high school and Crossed Brook Middle School. But before we dive into the world of academia, we're going to begin to the show by discussing the work and needs of an organization that has been providing vehicles for low-income Vermonters and New Englanders. Joining me to discuss Good News Garage is their Director of Operations, Cash Cranson. Cash, thanks for joining us today on Vermont Viewpoint.
Hey, Rick, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. Listeners, if you've got a question for Cash or if you've donated a vehicle to or received a vehicle from Good News Garage, give us a call, 244-1777-877-291-8255. Cash, why did Good News Garage get started?
Well, I'm not sure I'm fully qualified to answer that statement, but Good News Garage has a really awesome history that goes back in Vermont. It was started by a gentleman named Hal Colston, and he's kind of a legendary figure in our organization. I've had the pleasure of meeting him just recently. We celebrated our 25th anniversary of giving cars in the community. So it kind of started as his brainchild. You know, he was, my understanding, and I'm sure I'll butcher it, and he'd correct me, but, you know, he
Do
was...
Do your best.
He was a member of his local Lutheran church. I think he was in hospitality at that point. And he was seeing folks who had this need to fix cars, right? And maybe getting worked over by repair shops or not having the money, doing repairs they didn't need. And I think he just kind of got interested in that. He knew there was a solution there that was obtainable for low-income folks that would keep them, you know, going to work and in cars longer. And it kind of snowballed, I think. I'm sure I'm simplifying this, but as he talked with folks, there was interest, and eventually he kind of congealed enough of the community together to start a little pilot of it.
During a typical year, when we're not in a pandemic, how many cars, how many people do you help with vehicles in Vermont and throughout New England?
Great. So we award vehicles in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Vermont historically. And I would say there's a little bit of variation there year to year, but in general, it's 150 to 175 vehicles per year. You know, and I'm not sure, depending on someone's context, whether that sounds like a lot or a little. So I think I'll just, you know, it's quite a bit of vehicles. You know, the need far outstrips the supply here, but us being able to essentially give a vehicle every other day to someone in need in the New England region is a big deal. We're proud of it, and it's quite a bit that goes into that.
Yeah, 175 a year, right? That is one car going to someone every other day, so that takes a lot of work, and that's what we're going to talk about. But first of all, who are the people that you help with a vehicle?
So that varies a little bit state to state. In general, we have partnerships with the state, with, you know, so in Vermont, for instance, we partner with ReachUp. And so folks who qualify for a vehicle or folks who are qualifying for ReachUp and have an employment need, right? So they need their vehicle to either, you know, search or obtain or maintain employment. And so that, you know, the demographics of who we award looks very different, and that can be all over the place. But in general, most of the folks that we work with, it's tied to employment, to either searching or keeping a job.
And are you usually able to award a car to all who apply? If not, how do you prioritize, you know, who gets a vehicle and which one?
Yeah, so that's really interesting, and the pandemic has really kind of changed that both and kind of swung full circle back. So we in Vermont, we actually don't choose who receives the vehicle, which sometimes makes things a little easier for us, but the state chooses who receives the vehicle. Mm-hmm. And what I will say is we cannot award a vehicle to everyone who needs one. There is always more people that need a vehicle. And that parallel is true in Vermont. It's true in New Hampshire and Mass where we operate. And it's true all across the nation, to be frank. And so we don't always have enough vehicles to award people who need them.
Mm. So the state decides then, you know, what the priority is. How does someone apply for vehicle cash?
So they'd go, if they're not part of ReachUp, they'd have to go and become part of ReachUp. That's their starting point. And then they work with a caseworker over at ReachUp, and they'd, you know, do some needs assessment, and then that's, and they would kind of, track them over onto our waiting list for a vehicle.
And then is it a kind of a rolling application process? In other words, there's not a deadline by a certain day or time, but, really just you apply as needed.
Yes, correct. There's no deadline. It's rolling, and it is needs based.
And what kind of information would people need to supply in order to be considered for a car from Good News Garage?
So I'm sure my ReachUp partners here will correct me. I have a manager, Wanda Robar, who's excellent. I should probably call her up and get her the details. But essentially, you know, folks are going to have to show, you know, it's income based, right? So you're mm-hmm. going to have proof of income or proof of lack of income, frankly, right? Because a lot of folks are unemployed or they're folks in transition. And so they're going to have their basic demographic information to go and be a part of ReachUp. You know, they're going to have to show residency. They're going to have to show income. But I don't want to speak on behalf of ReachUp because I will get it wrong. And they essentially do that. In Vermont, they do that portion of the work for us.
Okay.
But if you're in need, reach out to your local ReachUp or, you know, however we don't call it town welfare or anything anymore, but you're gonna call your local assistance office. You can even call 211 in New Hampshire, and they'll probably even route you up in Vermont correctly. So there's a lot of different ways to access it, but you're gonna need to get a hold of ReachUp to kind of be eligible.
Okay. Now, looking at the other side of the equation, what are the requirements or the restrictions for the cars that you accept that are donated to Good News Garage?
Very little requirements, right? So one of the challenges I've kind of alluded to is, you know, we don't ever have enough, as many cars as we need for the need that exists out there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So our basic model is when we get a car that we can fix up reliably and safely, we're going to fix it up and award to a family or an individual in need. And I think that's a point of distinction that I want to highlight here. You know, we have a lot of competition, and I'm sure we might go into that, with other car donation charities that exist now. When we started, there really wasn't. We were kind of the only business in town. But now we have a lot of other competition. And so we want to, you know, if you're remotely thinking about donating, we're going to take it. There's a few exceptions to that. You know, essentially, we come and tow it, right? And we'll take it off your hands for free. You're going to get a tax letter. And as a charitable contribution, you know, and so occasionally if something is going to cost us too much money, right? It's going to cost us money to come tow, and it's not, it's too old or it's too rusty. We can't use it for parts. We can't, sell it for salvage because it's just too far gone. We might refuse that, you know, or essentially every once in a while we get someone trying to use us as a junkyard. Mm-hmm. And, we will probably say no in those cases, but we're very community minded and we rarely say no. So if you're thinking about donating, we will have a use for your vehicle. We might not be able to make your vehicle what we call a program car, right? So,
and is that one that gets donated to someone in need? The program
exactly.
car? Okay.
Exactly. And for that, you know, so this kind of ties back to your original question, right? So there's no hard parameter there. There's not a year cutoff necessarily.
Mileage, but essentially, maximum or anything like that?
Yeah, there's not a hard and fast mileage maximum. I will say that if they start getting super high mileage in Vermont, what we see is problems with the underbody, right? So we mm-hmm. see rust in the frame.
Yep.
And that's, you know, we're not going to fix that car and give it to someone because it'll be a headache for them 6 months, 12 months down the line. We warranty all the cars that we give to individuals for a full year.
Wow.
You know, essentially, we will fix all the cars that we can that it makes sense. And when we don't, we'll either auction the car off and we use those proceeds. We sink that revenue back into fixing the other cars that we can. That's kind of our basic business model. So, you know, we get a ton of end-of-life cars, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think people, they have cars and people get attached to their vehicles, and we get a lot of vehicles that people feel like we might be able to fix up, but it just doesn't make sense. It's been sitting for 4 years. You know, the tranny's blown. It's got all this, you know, we need to do $6,000, $7,000 of work to it. We're not going to fix that car because it doesn't make sense to the individual in the end or to our business, but we fix everything we can and award everything we can.
Why do
a really cool model.
Those who donate cash, why do people donate their car to Good News Garage rather than sell it or trade it in?
Yeah, great question. And, you know, I don't always entirely know, right? But from some of the conversations I've had with repeat donors or folks that I've just happened to talk with at the time, you know, I think a lot of times people hear we have great word of mouth and a great word of mouth reputation in Vermont especially, but even in the other local New England states we work. You know, so someone donated in the past and they had a great experience and they see the testimonial. So, you know, we will send thank yous to our donors, and when it's a program car, we usually have the individual or the family that received the car send a thank you, and I think that goes a long way with the person who donated, where they see, wow, my car is really changing someone's life.
Yeah.
And they have a face to put to that. They have a real person, you know, it's not just marketing. And so I think that word of mouth really helps us, and so I think a lot of people hear that or they know of it, and they're kind of aligned with the mission. You know, they say, well, I could, you know, maybe take the time to trade this in and get a nominal amount, if that, or I could change a family's life, and they kind of choose that way. So I think that's the primary motivation that folks will donate to us.
Yeah.
But, you know, I can't always be certain. And people come from all different places that donate for us and all different motivations. And, you know, we're not discriminating there. We'll take it. You know, mm-hmm. If you're motivated to donate it, we need it. So,
Cash, once you get a car, once it's received there at Good News Garage, what is done to the vehicle?
So that will really depend on the vehicle, but essentially we have staff that will kind of do an initial assessment, right? And they're seeing, hey, is there anything blatantly obvious here that's going to kind of prevent us from fixing it? And if it looks good, you know, if there's not a rusty frame, if they can start it, you know, some other basic kind of evaluation standard stuff, then they're going to bring it into one of our partner garages. So we used to have our own garage and our own in-house staff, and now we kind of subcontract it out and partner with some other local independent garages all around Vermont. And then those folks will go and do a more thorough evaluation, and they'll come up with kind of a work order for it, and we decide whether we're going to follow through that work order or not, and that'll be depending on, you know, how much we need to go into the car and how long we're going to get out of the car. And of course, you know, it's not always black and white, right? You know, with cars, you can't always predict everything, but essentially that's what we'll do, and then we'll fix the car up with the garage, and then we award it to someone. And that process can take as little as 2 weeks. It can take, you know, as long as a month. Sometimes it'll take even longer than that. But but we can turn them around pretty quick sometimes.
All right, let's take a call from Pam, who's joining us from Duxbury. Hi, Pam.
Morning, Rick.
Morning.
I just want to say that we've donated 2 cars to Good News Garage. Very easy to work with. I'm not a car negotiator because I know they only take me from point A to point B, so mm-hmm. to try to sell it outright would be pointless for me. And it's just quick, efficient, and such a good cause. But one thing I'll say to Crash is you need a jingle like 1-800-CAR for kids.
Listening to
the Red Sox. So. I know they're not affiliated with you, but
no.
Boy, does that stick in your head. But anyway, I appreciate the work you do, and I'm glad that it's benefiting the people who need it.
Well, Pam, thank you for the call, and thanks for donating 2 of your vehicles to Good News Garage. And like Pam said, it was a very easy process, Cash. So tell us a little bit about, you know, what that process is for the person who is donating a car to Good News Garage.
Great. Thank you so much, Pam, for your donations and for your testimonial. That means a lot, and it's great to hear. We work really hard to try to provide a seamless experience as a donor. So you, it's as simple as whatever your comfort level is for technology. You can go online and we have a donor form right on our website. You click the link, you add some of your basic information, and then you'll get an email from or a phone call from our Good News Garage staff in Vermont. You'll probably get a phone call. Down in New Hampshire, you'll get an email initially. You can call. We have a 1-800 number, but we also have a direct office number, and start the process that way. And then what's really fun is up in Vermont, we still have an office right in the heart of Burlington, and people come in from the community all the time to donate their car in person. And I think that's really unique and great, and we love that option. So, you know, phone, computer, walk in, you know, that we'll get it done and we'll make it easy for you for there. You know, we will come tow. If you can't bring it in, we will tow it off your hands no matter where you are in Vermont. And the one thing is we need the title. But if you don't have the title, don't worry. We can apply for another title if you don't have the title. So don't let that stop you. But we really try to make it as easy as possible. And this is kind of along Pam's comments too. You know, we have a lot of competition and, Cars for Kids and their very memorable jingle, is definitely, we need one. You know, we've got Pass Your Keys to Your Neighbor in Need, which our, I think Tom, our marketing guy came up with, and we love that. But, in all seriousness, you know, Cars for Kids has a multi-million dollar marketing budget alone, and that's what we're going up against, as competition here. And again, the big differentiator is that, Cars for Kids probably, you know, does some great stuff, but they do not award the vehicles that you donate directly to an individual. And we feel strongly that that's an important distinction for us in New England here. You know, if you donate your car, there's a very real likelihood that that vehicle could be fixed and go to a neighbor.
I love that. There was a bit of a Freudian slip there. Pam called you Crash, which would not be a great name for a guy who's working for Good News Garage. It's Cash Cranson. Just want to make sure people understand that. Hey, Cash, can you share a story maybe of someone, you don't have to mention names, but who has received a vehicle from Good News Garage, you know, maybe here in Vermont, and how that's changed their life?
That's such a timely question. I actually had a conversation yesterday with an individual that I know through a personal association in my personal life. Essentially, we exercise together. And this individual asked me what I did for work yesterday, and I explained, and she said, "Oh my goodness, I got a car 7 years ago from you guys and it was life changing." And I said, "Really?"
Wow.
And she, you know, I'm friends with this person's husband as well. And she said, "Yeah, I wouldn't have met my husband. I wouldn't," and she has an accounting job now. And she says, "I wouldn't have been able to get this job. Like, it was all truly due to that car." And, you know, for me, being in this work every day, and, you know, there's a marketing element, right? We have to go up against Cars for Kids. But to hear that testimonial from someone that I knew in my personal life, completely unaffiliated with my Good News Garage Association, absolutely floored me. And this person's doing well. You know, they've got an 11-year-old child and a good job. And this person, without prompting, really attributed the start of that trajectory towards their receipt of a Good News Garage vehicle. And that meant a lot to me. So
yeah.
I think what's fun is I think that testimonial is echoed probably across a lot of individuals we award cars to. But that just happened yesterday, Rick, so I got to share.
Nicely done. Now let's talk about a couple things that have affected the car market overall, the chip shortage, for instance. How is that impacting Good News Garage?
It's making, like you mentioned earlier, it's making things even tougher for us, right? It's always tough because essentially we rely on donations as our lifeblood. And so now folks, you know, if you go to a dealer lot anywhere across Vermont or New England, you're going to see way less cars than you saw before.
Yeah.
Auto auctions that we partner with, you know, whereas on a Saturday they might run 115 cars through an auction, they're lucky if they're running 20, 30 through auction right now. Because people are hanging on to their cars more, right? Because it's not as easy to replace. You know, they're going to have to pay a premium if they go in and trade it in for a new car. And so, because of that, we're seeing less and less donations. And of course, that kind of trickles down, so to speak, to our low-income folks that we serve, right? And they, you know, kind of receive, there's less to give, so that impact hits them even harder. And so, you know, we've been aware of this in this industry and have kind of tried to do our best to plan around it and do our best to get creative in different ways and kind of turn over new rocks so we can keep the donations coming in, but it's affecting us. You know, we're seeing less donations significantly, and we've got a rough couple months ahead. So that's definitely a concern for us.
Mm. The other thing is the superheated used car market. People are getting more for the used cars, so they might be less inclined to donate it to Good News Garage. Are you feeling that effect as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's hand in hand there, you know. And, you know, for instance, we this past month awarded less cars than we historically do, right, mm-hmm. because we simply didn't have them to fix up. And so that, you know, while we kind of saw that coming and we're not completely blindsided, it's still, we always want to be able to award as many cars as we can. You know, I'm optimistic that with more conversations like this and more visibility, hopefully we'll continue to increase our donations and we'll climb out of this. And especially as the chip shortage becomes less and less impactful, the market might kind of settle down a little bit, which will hopefully increase our donations. But right now we're feeling the pinch.
What are the advantages of donating a car to Good News Garage?
So I would start with that testimonial that I just shared, right? A huge advantage is that you are creating change in someone's life. You are helping someone keep a job, get to an appointment. Maybe just the little things that we forget, like being able to go to the grocery store, you know, when you need something. Transportation and transportation equity is a huge issue nationally and in Vermont. And so when you donate a vehicle to Good News Garage, you're directly contributing to a solution to that. And to a solution for transportation challenges that people have. I think also, you know, you get a tax letter, right? Historically, that has been more impactful. The tax code is not quite as, it's not quite as big of a benefit as it has been historically, but you still get a tax write-off. If we mm-hmm. award it to a program participant, you get the full value of $6,000 of the vehicle. If we sell it at auction because we can't fix it, you'll get whatever the amount that we receive for it at auction as a tax letter. So I think those are kind of the two major ones. I'm sure I'm missing some here, but it's and the other, I guess the last thing I'd hammer on is because we're local, you're helping a neighbor, right? Yeah. So if you give the Good News Garage, hopefully it's easy and you're helping your own community. You know, there's a lot of other car donation programs we've mentioned and I'm sure they're doing good things too, but here you're having local impact. And so that might be important to a possible donor.
There are a couple more programs that Good News Garage has called One's Ready to Go. Another is a child safety seat fitting. And you can find information about all that at goodnewsgarage.org. Cash Cranson is the Director of Operations for Good News Garage. Cash, thanks so much for being with us this morning.
Rick, thanks so much for having me.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break. Then we're going to return to hear about a high school writing contest. That's a collaboration between NVU and the League of Vermont Writers. And the Sox back at it tonight, opening up a 3-game series in Baltimore as they battle for a wild card playoff spot. Our coverage begins at 6:05, first pitch, 7:05. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. I taught a writing class at Miami University and was a little surprised when students told me they never had a class in high school or college where they really were encouraged or taught to write creatively. These were public relations and mass communications majors. Now, that was 2 decades ago, and I'm hoping the landscape has changed a lot since then. If it hasn't, thank goodness for my next 2 guests. They're involved in the Vermont High School Writing Contest. Joining me now to discuss the contest is Tyrone Shaw. He's a writing and literature professor at Northern Vermont University. Tyrone, thanks for being on the show this morning.
My pleasure, Rick. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And we also have Hank Parker. He's an author, oceanographer, expeditioner, and an adjunct associate professor at Georgetown University's School of Medicine. Hank, that is an incredible resume. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks very much, Rick. Glad to be with you this morning.
Now, listeners, to ask our guests about the writing contest, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. The email address, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Tyrone, what is the Vermont High School Writing Contest?
As the name suggests, it is just that, basically. It's a contest open to all high school students, public, private, homeschool, whatever, grades 9 through 12, to strut their stuff. There's three categories, fiction, nonfiction, and poetry, and students are encouraged to submit entries to the website. We encourage students to do this because we want to honor students' efforts at creative writing. We think it's important to nurture the next generation of writers. And Hank and I got together and decided that this contest would be a really good thing. Hank, representing the League of Vermont Writers, and I'm sure he'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. NVU Johnson has had a long history of a creative writing Bachelor of Fine Arts program. And that's where we kind of come into the picture, because this was a similar contest existed up to about 12 years ago, and it was an essay contest only. And it was discontinued, I think, for a number of practical but ill-advised reasons. And we decided we were going to revive it and expand it with a panel of 9 judges, 3 for each category. And here we are. It launched September 1st, and it closes, entries close November 15th.
And
so
Hank,
that's basically what it is.
Yep. Hank, when are the winners chosen for the three categories?
Well, the judges will review all of the submissions after November 15th, and we will announce the winners based on the judges' conclusions on or about the 15th of January. And then once the winners are announced, the winners and runners-up for each category, there will be an event hosted by Northern Vermont University in Johnson for the winners and runners-up, their families, their teachers, and the school administrators.
I do love that it's on or about January 15th when the winners will be chosen. I love that. That tells me more about your creativity and less about how rigid the rules are. Now, what are the different categories, Hank, that are in the writing contest?
Fiction, nonfiction, and poetry.
And are there different age groups?
No, we are opening it to every Vermont high school student from grades 9 through grade 12.
And Tyrone, what about those who are homeschooled here in Vermont?
They are encouraged to submit as well, and we've done our best through listservs and other ways of contacting the homeschool groups around the state to get the word out, and apparently the word is getting out, because this morning I heard from one of our neighbors that they are aware of the contest, which is great, not having heard about it from me.
Do you have any idea how many submissions you're expecting this year?
No. That's part of the fun of this for us. we're hoping for a robust response. At this point, however, we don't know.
All right. Now, Hank, why is this something you and the League of Vermont Writers are involved in?
Well, the League has been around for, boy, almost 100 years with some luminaries in its memberships and past officers and so on. Speakers at the League events have included the likes of Robert Frost. But as I got involved with the League, I think, 4 or 5 years ago, I now serve on their board. But we are overwhelmingly an older group, and we've talked a lot about what we can do to reach out to younger aspiring writers to involve them not only in the league's activities, but to enjoy writing in general. And so about a year or two ago, Tyrone and I began talking about this, and we thought that a partnership between Northern Vermont University and the league would be a great way to go. The goal, obviously, is to do all we can to encourage young writers in Vermont to write, and those who have ever even thought about writing to give it a try.
What is the league, Hank, and what are the activities that you usually are involved in?
Well, the league is basically an organization that draws writers together from throughout the state in a variety of through a variety of mechanisms, including regular meetings, online. We have an online book club. We have an online at this point because of COVID opportunity for writers to read their read excerpts from their material to other writers, and we partner as much as possible with other organizations in the state that that are involved with or have interest in writing.
And Tyrone, I asked Hank why the league is involved. Why is this something that NVU has gotten behind?
As I had briefly mentioned just a little while ago, we've had a long history of a BFA in creative writing, first at Johnson State College, then at NVU Johnson, and soon to be Vermont State University at Johnson.
That's a whole other story, but yes.
It is, and the head reels. But anyway, the heart is steady. We've long had a tradition of nurturing writers on this campus, and to some extent, Lyndon certainly shares in this tradition. It's important for us to keep that flame alive and pay attention to the next generation coming up, which would be our high school students. So it's been a natural interest of ours to do this. There's very few public colleges and universities that have Bachelor of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. Johnson is one of them, or NVU Johnson now is one of them, the only one in the state and one of the few in New England. So it's been part of our identity and a signature program for decades at Johnson. The program is designed basically around the model used in Master of Fine Arts for graduate schools, and it's served us and our students very well. We want to perpetuate that, and we want to expand interest in creative writing, and that's where we really come into this.
I'll ask you both this question. Tyrone, you first. Did you participate in anything like this when you were in high school?
Absolutely not. Had there been something like that, I certainly would have. But no, I didn't.
Hank, how about you?
No, that's actually a very interesting question. One of the, my primary motivations for helping to promote this contest. I took English courses, as we all probably mm-hmm. did in high school, and I will just simply say that the. I didn't get the kind of encouragement that I hoped I would get. I got a lot of criticism. I thought originally that I wanted to write. I actually ended up being a scientist, and it took a long time to come back around to the writing idea. No contests and not a lot of encouragement, although a lot of criticism. And I think I actually got a good foundation in writing. It's just that encouragement piece that was lacking.
It reminds me of Harlan Ellison talking about being in a large kind of amphitheater for his freshman literature course at Ohio State University. And his first paper he got back from his professor that said, "You'll never be a writer." And there you go. So
the comment I got from my primary English teacher in high school, just one comment at the end of a short story I'd written, he said, "You tend to the sesquipedalian." I had to look that up, and maybe you will want to do that.
What does it mean? I have no idea.
You used words that are too long.
Oh, okay. Perfect. Hank, who are the judges for this contest?
Well, Tyrone has the actual names if he feels that we're okay to release those at this point. But okay. There are three for each category. They're comprised of writers who either live and work in Vermont or have strong Vermont roots.
Tyrone, did you want to release those names, or do you want to just tell us, you know, how they reacted when you approached them about being judges for a contest like this?
The reaction was overwhelmingly positive to begin with, and I think especially the judges were impressed with the possibility of helping to nurture the next generation of writers. And that's the hook, I think, for a lot of these folks.
Mm-hmm.
I really hesitate yet to release the names. We were going to do that closer to the close of submissions.
All right. We'll let that be. Yeah, I think that's absolutely fine.
Many of them will be very familiar to Vermonters.
All right. And Tyrone, win, lose, you know, what is the benefit to young writers who enter this contest?
I think there are numerous benefits, one of which is just to have submitted something, to put your work out there, to have the self-confidence to do so.
Mm-hmm.
Writers learn pretty early on in their careers that rejection is a fact of life. And obviously, if we have a lot of submissions, most people are not going to win first places. But it's a way of getting into the game and starting to learn the rhythm of the writing life. The second benefit is your work is going to be read by other people.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a real chance of it getting to a wider audience. And I think that's really important that students have the confidence to submit their work. Writers, ideally you write for yourself, but the reality is you don't write in a vacuum, and we writers need an audience. And this is a way for young writers to start understanding that.
If they win, what do they receive, Tyrone?
The winners receive $500. The runner-ups receive $100. And a shot at publishing in Green Mountains Review, either the hard copy or the web edition of that literary magazine, as well as the publication with the League of Vermont Writers. And there also the possibility, this is just becoming apparent to us, of being part of some kind of ebook anthology.
Mm. Now, I am going to get personal with the two of you for a question each right now. Hank, you first, in 2017, you wrote Containment, and it was described as a race against time to both find a vaccine and unravel a bioterrorist conspiracy when a terrifying new tick-borne virus is traced to an extremist group in Southeast Asia. First of all, looking back now, are you some kind of a seer? You know, what were you thinking back then? And then when the pandemic happened, I know it's a little different from the plot, but it almost seems like you knew.
Hardly knew. One of my later assignments at the U.S. Department of Agriculture had to do with Homeland Security and helping to protect the country against deliberate attacks against food and agriculture. So I perhaps learned more than I ever thought I wanted to know about viruses and other pathogens that might attack animals or people.
Mm.
And so this notion of a so-called zoonotic disease that could be transmitted between animals and people had been percolating in my mind for a long time. So that was the impetus for the novel.
Wow. Did sales of Containment jump during the pandemic?
I wish they had.
I was hoping the answer was yes.
Not as much as I'd like.
All right. And Tyrone, you've been a news director at a radio station. Did you know we're looking for a morning and noon news host here?
I did not.
I want you to keep that in the back of your mind there. But you're also a member of a longtime Vermont band, so tell us a little bit about the Oleo Romeos.
Oh, good Lord, you don't want to know about my not best-selling book? Well, first, the Olio Romeos, we're a legend in our own living room. I, as you probably know, was in the Throbulators for the whole time that that band was going. And the Olios bear scant resemblance to the Throbulators, both unfortunately and fortunately. There's not much to say about it. We generally would do private gigs, parties, weddings, not so much club work. But since COVID, we have been, shall we say, on deep hiatus, and we'll probably remain that way.
All right. All right, I am going to steer this conversation back to the Vermont High School Writing Contest. Hank, what would you say to encourage high school students to enter this contest?
My strong belief is that everyone has a creative urge of some kind. And but in many, many cases, it's not expressed because of, you know, fear or discouragement or you know, any other reason that one doesn't feel confident in putting themselves out in public. So I would say to a high school student considering this, this is an opportunity to write something that will be read by a distinguished panel of judges, that you don't have to worry whether or not it's going to be shared with the broader public. It's an opportunity just to express yourself in writing. And if you're fortunate enough to be a winner or runner-up, so much the better. But if not, at least you've given it a shot, and hopefully you'll be encouraged to continue doing that in the future.
Tyrone, are there any rules regarding having someone edit your submission to make sure that, you know, it's just right? Is that allowed?
It's a very interesting question, and one that I don't think we've directly considered. We're assuming that the work that's submitted is one's own work.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that outside editing interference or additions or modifications might well violate the spirit of this contest, although at the same time, every writer needs a good editor. Mm-hmm. We want to be sure that what we're reading reflects the work and ability of the writer, however that happens.
All right. And we've got a minute left, Tyrone, so let's recap the details for people who are interested, how they enter, what they can submit, et cetera.
2,000-word max, no matter what the submission, whether it's fiction, nonfiction, or poetry. One entry per person. You can't enter one in each category. You've got to choose one and commit to it. Pay attention to the submission guidelines, which are clearly established on the website, and I would like to give everybody that address,
sure,
which is www.northernvermont.edu/Vermont-high-school-writing-contest.
All right. That's Tyrone Shaw.
I'll take you right there and give you all the information you need, especially at the bottom of the page. There'll be a place that says call for entry and submissions guidelines, and you just click on that, and it's all there for you.
All right. Tyrone Shaw is writing and literature professor at Northern Vermont University. Hank Parker is an author, oceanographer, expeditioner, and an adjunct associate professor at Georgetown University School of Medicine. I am not making that up. To learn more about the Vermont High School Writing Contest, I'll make it easier for you folks. Just go to northernvermont.edu and search the high school contest. Tyrone, Hank, thanks for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for having us.
Sure thing.
Thank you, Rick.
All right, take care. We're going to take a break for the news, and then we're going to spend the 10 o'clock hour discussing the Harwood Unified Union School District's proposed $60 million bond issue. And today at 1 o'clock, equal time with Travin here on WDEV, and then we've got 120 musical minutes of The Getaway with the ever-gregarious Greg Hooker. This is the Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We'll be right back.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. It's difficult for school districts to get annual school budgets passed sometimes, but large capital improvement expenditures are an even bigger ask. And if things that need to get done get put off, they get a special name, deferred maintenance. But what happens when those items are deferred for too long? Maybe you wind up with what's happened at Burlington High School. The Harwood Unified Union School District is facing some major needs, going to ask its constituents to decide on a bond issue of just under $60 million for renovations to Harwood Union High School and to add on to Crossett Brook Middle School. Joining us this morning for the whole hour is the Harwood Unified Union School District Chair, Tori Smith. Tori, thanks for being on the program this morning.
I'm so glad to be here with you. Thank you for having us.
You're welcome. And we also have the vice chair of the board, Tim Jones, here as well. Tim, thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thank you.
Good morning. Listeners from the Harwood District, this is an excellent opportunity to get any questions about the bond issue answered or to voice your opinion. You can call us 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255, and then the email address vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And Tori and Tim, I hope you don't mind if I just round up and call it a $60 million bond issue throughout this interview this morning.
That's fine.
All right, good. I know it's just under, it's in the 59 millions, but to make it simple. Okay, Tori, first of all, when did the board start exploring this bond proposal?
Well, in a lot of ways, we actually started exploring this in 2015 before we had merged as a district. It was clear even at that point when we still had only, you know, a high school board and we had each of the towns had their own boards, it was already clear that there was a lot of deferred maintenance that did need to be addressed at Harwood. And deferred maintenance is a little bit of a funny term because it implies that we weren't maintaining all along. But in fact, we were maintaining all along. But even then, we had a 50-year-old building, and a lot of the equipment was 50 years old. So there aren't a lot of things that we use in our lives these days on an everyday basis, you know, cars, you know, refrigerators, things like that last 50 years. So that's really what we've been stumbling up against. And then when Act 46 came along, really the district kind of needed to focus on that because that was going to have some major implications for budgeting, for planning, and there were, you know, laws that we were going to have to follow about that. So we switched focus to that. In 2018, we picked it up again. We updated our facility evaluation and got new numbers and started to try to make a plan, but realized that one of the big challenges was that we had this newer part of the building. There was one part of the building that was a little bit newer, which had been built in the late 90s, which housed our 7th and 8th graders at Harwood. And the question was sort of, well, do we just leave that part of the building alone? Do we improve that part of the building? What do we do? And then there were questions of, well, maybe we should bring everybody together, all the 7th and 8th graders. So we really had trouble making a plan until we could figure out what to do, how best to, you know, provide programming for the 7th and 8th graders. So over time, the board came to agreement that the best path forward would be to move the 7th and 8th graders together at Crossett Brook Middle School. So that really, I would say, solidified this past spring. We had had some, you know, hints that we were going to head that way, but it really was solidified by a unanimous or nearly unanimous vote this spring that would we would expand Crossett Brook, move the 7th and 8th graders over there, and then we would be able to finish the project on the high school. So the project has been sort of in development for years, but really in the last year has come together to look like it looks now.
And Tim, when was the last time that the school board in some form has proposed a bond, and maybe what was that for?
To be honest, in my memory, I don't recall one. I believe
Is it maybe one of the schools in Waterbury, and in Thatcherbrook, certainly back in 98, I believe, you know, the high school saw some expansion. But again, I think this is somewhat unparalleled in terms of any scope or scale of any prior ask.
Mm-hmm.
I think in my memory, or really memory of most folks in the community.
Tori, any that you can remember?
Yeah, there were two big investments that our six towns made about almost 30 years ago now in the late 90s. And that was to add the middle school at Crossetbrook, or turn that into a 4-8. That was when Waterbury-Duxbury merged. And there was also the decision to add the 7th and 8th grade wing to Harwood. More recently, there were some smaller projects. Warren had a repair project. They, too, had some overdue repairs that needed to be made. And that happened right before the districts merged. And about 15 years ago, Thatcherbrook had a pretty major, which is now Brookside Primary, had a pretty major overhaul as well. So there has been very little request for funds to reinvest in Harwood in the 50 years since it was built.
And Tori, the board had a bond survey conducted recently. When was this done, and what were the main topics that were asked about?
Yeah, we've done two bond surveys in the last year. The first one was this past spring, and that was really about just decisions related to the middle school, trying to get a sense of how the public felt about the scale and the size of the project for the middle school, if we needed to do it, if they thought we should. You know, also one of the questions at that time was, do we put some temporary buildings there first, move the kids over, get everything started, or do we wait until we have a permanent building in place? So the survey from that informed the decision-making in the spring, which was to build out Crossetbrook and then move students together. And then the second survey was just this past fall, and that was more specific to the types of projects that are included in the bond. So, you know, what's your support level for the gym? What's your support level for the track? Trying to understand more about the public's perceptions around some of those projects.
And Tim, what were some of the more telling results from that survey, the most recent survey?
You know, my takeaway is that there is strong support, certainly to bring, you know, the needs of the high school to a more modern standard to match up or dovetail with, you know, the sort of the 21st century learning model. So I don't think there's a lot of support out there. I think, you know, the middle school component, I think also has some support in there. And I think where, you know, I think the takeaway is when we got into some of the other, you know, ancillary parts of the bond, you know, the high school gym or the track is, you know, maybe where we have some detractors in terms of, you know, is it needed? You know, is it something that we want, something that we need? So I think it's been great feedback for us. We had over 500 respondents, which I think, you know, in my 3 years on the board has probably, you know, a high watermark for participation. So, you know, the results and also the attendant comments came along with it. I think, you know, even detractors, you know, are encouraging, you know, one thing or another. But I think the takeaway for the board, I think at our table was, you know, there is some broad community support for this.
There was a major question about whether or not the board should propose the bond, Tim. So how did your respondents react to that question?
I think it's time. There really is no other, you know, avenue. And I think what we're trying to convey is, in order, if this is not something the community is behind, we're going to have to go about some of these other needs and deferred maintenance another way. So I think, as Tari mentioned, you know, we've been talking about this for a number of years. So I think, you know, prevailing wisdom and support there is that, you know, this is the vehicle to take to the community for, you know, this generational ask, if you will.
And Tari, now Tim did, you know, touch on these, but what were the responses about the specific needs for the two schools? What did you learn about
that? Yeah, while you were talking, I was able to pull up the survey so I can look at it more exactly.
All right, good.
So, you know, the question around should we propose the bond this November or should we skip the bond and just try to fix it in another way? The answer was, I'm going to use some just, it was 74% in favor of proposing this November and 26% against. And we actually also had about 25% throughout the survey who said no bond, no bond, no bond. So although I do not know if that was the overlap there, there is a fairly decent chance that there was a lot of overlap in that number.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the challenge is if we don't do the bond this November, then we still need to do these repairs. And we have $22 million of past due repairs to do. We have another $14 million in imminent repairs. So we can do them now, or we can find ourselves in a past due situation in 5 years. So that's almost $34 million. We do have a maintenance reserve fund in our district. It's about $1.5 million, and it is to maintain all seven campuses. And so that $34 million, or $36 million I was just referring to, is actually just for hardwoods repairs. So the truth is we cannot cover that out of the maintenance reserve budget. And in order to then do those repairs, we have to increase the annual spending enormously. And the way the state's tax formula works, that will actually penalize us even more than if we just did this through the bond.
Yeah. And when you asked about how much the bond proposal should be, how did people respond to that?
Let me slide down my report to
see what we saw.
I love these questions. Thank you. Okay, so we had 13% of people said they thought they would support something for $40 million. Let's see, another 15, almost 16% said that they would support for $50 million. So I think what we could, and then 30.5% said $60 million. So, and we had another 16% that said $70 million. And then we had that same 25% that they don't support a bond. So if we look, if we say we're about 60, we did have, you know, almost 45, 46% of people saying that they are willing to support a bond that high. So what we're hoping to do is in the, you know, next month, get enough information out there that more people will see that this is, in fact, a wise investment for our community.
Tim, let's look at what that $60 million will cover. First of all, give us kind of the big picture, the big idea of what the $60 million is for.
Sure. So I think at our last meeting, as we voted to put this proposal forward, we broke it up into four buckets. Tari's done a great job, masterful job, really, of sort of breaking this out so we can chew on all the pieces individually. So I'd say, you know, the bulk of this, 20-plus million dollars, is for sort of the deferred maintenance, I guess, is that the term we've used today, or it's for the needs or bringing the facility at Harwood, you know, up to code compliance, if you will. We've had a, you know, great partnership with some professional services firms, Trux Collins and ReArch, together with our building administrators to put together really a great background on, you know, the state of the school and pictures and just sort of helping us, you know, virtually look through the school at what needs to be done. And so that total is just something just north of $20 million. The other two pieces at Harwood are the addition of a second gym, which, again, prevailing wisdom is, you know, the facility that we have right now, while it's serviceable and accommodates our needs, certainly, I think, you know, the advice that we're getting is another gym or a second gym would certainly help, you know, not only alleviate some of the scheduling issues in the school. Sorry, I'm about my dog here.
That's all right. And, we love dogs here.
and really sort of bring that up to standard. And, again, help, you know, also, you know, parlay that and use that as a community space as well. So a more modern facility, helps, you know, with our learning institution, but it's also an opportunity to welcome in more community uses on the property. The track, I think, is something that's been talked about for some time as well in terms of the condition of our track and other schools' willingness to come here and participate in meets, given the condition of that track. So, yeah, and something that's been talked about, you know, for a number of years. It's the original track, I believe, over there, and it's something that I believe, you know, again, based on the success of that athletic program,
at Harwood is, you know, again, investing in our athletics. I think we're in agreement that, that's a wise investment to make. And then lastly, the CrossFit Brook piece, as Tari mentioned, at the outset, the plan is to, consolidate our middle school and move all our middle schoolers, to CrossFit Brook. And part of our decision making there as a board was, you know, if and when that happens, it's only going to happen, if we're able to add on to the school classrooms. And what's also morphed in there is, more community space. So sort of back to that, you know, original discussion of the gym is, yes, we need, you know, sort of a bare minimum number of classrooms to accommodate, the student body. But our, you know, school professionals have said, hey, you know, it would really be ideal, if we could also put a community, space on that, not only, you know, for assembly type uses and other uses within, you know, the learning environment. But again, I think, you know, ode to the community is, we'd like to see some community spaces, across the community. We don't have a community center, anywhere across our communities here. So again, I think it's an added benefit of making these upgrades is, you know, it can be a community resource as well.
And Tim, how much of the $60 million is for the high school? How much for CrossFit Brook Middle School?
I think most of it, with the exception of about $6 million, is for the high school.
All right. All right, good. So about, approximately $54 million for the high school, $6 million for CrossFit Brook. Tari, what are the enrollments of the schools affected by the proposed bond?
You keep giving me the numbers question. I'm going to have to look that one up. I don't know it off the top of my head. I have approximations. I promise to look that up, but if I could.
Please do.
Of the $54 million that's for Harwood, about two-thirds of it is really just these repairs and improvements.
Mm-hmm.
And then about a third of it is what we're calling educational alignment. So one thing I hope people can understand is that this building, which has served our community very well for 55 years, was built in 55 years ago. 1965, we had not landed a person on the moon yet. And so try to think back to what life was like then. You know, teaching and learning was the teacher stands in front of the classroom and basically says, okay, memorize this. Okay, memorize that. Okay, now tell me what I said. And teaching and learning today is really a completely different thing. It's all about collaboration. It's all about problem solving. It's about, you know, using resources outside the school to create, you know, learning opportunities, internships. And so what we found is that our school building was beautifully designed for teaching in the 1960s. It is not as well designed for teaching in the 2020s. Although, you know, Tim talked about the gym and the track, and those are, they're sort of big ticket items that have effects for the school and for the community.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the change, actually $9 million of that $18 million bucket, is around making sort of nuanced changes to the building that will allow us to have more space for teachers to collaborate, for students to have discussions, meaning class discussions, for them to have opportunities for presentations. And, you know, it really just will renovate the school in some strategic ways that will help bring us up into the 2020s. A couple other projects include, like, creating a humanities hub, creating an innovation lab, which is actually designed to try to find more ways for hands-on learning. One of the things that has happened in the last couple decades is Votech has really been centralized throughout our state into these regional career centers. So we don't have any of that left at Harwood, and that's something that's really been missing, and we'd like to figure out how to bring back. So the Innovation Lab is one of the starting points for that. We're creating a ninth grade team space to help with this transition from junior high school to high school. So there are a lot of these sort of little changes that we can make altogether total up to $9 million, which is not a small amount, but the board and the principals really feel this is just an incredibly important and strategically planned investment that we can make at this time. And so we can have this high school serve the next generation too.
to add your
Sorry
point.
For that long answer.
That's okay. But to add to your point, Tari, in 1965, we didn't even have calculators in classrooms, let alone what we have today. I do want to ask about the merger. I'm sorry, the merger of the middle schools and how the proposed bond affects that. So, first of all, you know, if it's approved, what becomes of Harwood Union Middle School? If not approved, what happens with the merger of the middle schools? We have about 2.5 minutes.
So, the board has repeatedly decided that there have been several votes now that indicate the 7th and 8th graders will all be brought together at Crossett Brook. If the bond fails, it's not clear what will happen. You know, when this decision has come up before the board, it does decide to do that. It is a guess about what would happen. Some of it will depend on who's on the board. Some of it will depend on the research that we do if the bond fails to find out why did it fail. Was it because of that? Was it because of something else? It could be that they decide to go ahead and merge it anyways. It could be that they decide to put the bond forward again. So it is unclear at this time.
Hmm. All right. And, Tim, you know, one of the things, and we might have to cut you off and pick this up on the other side of the news, but one of the things that's mentioned is these improvements, not only for people living here now, the students going to school, but attracting other people to this area, to the school district. How does this bond proposal do that?
Well, I think it shows our community's focus on investing in our education and in our children. And certainly there are many, many young families that we've seen move into our communities over the last few years. So I think it does nothing but tell any prospective folks that are interested in our community that this has been a well thought out process. It's engaged all of the stakeholders, and we have our educators and professionals behind this. And as Tari mentioned, there are some other all of the educational attributes that flow out of this. So I believe we're fashioning ourselves to be able to, advertise, this is what our school district is all about. This is what our communities are all about. And, manifesting it through an investment like this in our education system, I think, speaks volumes about our interests.
Let's take a break for a CBS News update, and then we'll be back to continue our conversation with Tim Jones and Tari Smith of the Harwood Unified Union School District about the $60 million bond issue that will be voted on in November. Listeners, good time to hop on the phone with your questions or comments about the proposal. Our numbers are 244-1777. Toll free, it's 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. We're back with the Harwood Unified Union School District Chair Tari Smith and Vice Chair Tim Jones discussing the $60 million bond issue. Listeners, if you've got questions or concerns that you'd like to share with our guests, you can call us 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Tim, what are the major improvements being recommended for Crossett Brook Middle School?
The Crossett Brook Middle School improvements are proposed as, adding a sector of classrooms, if you will. So adding a number of classrooms that we agreed as a board would be necessary to comfortably accommodate. Having all of our 7th and 8th grade students at Crossett Brook with some dedicated space feel, if you will. And as those plans evolved, we've also brought forward the idea within the proposal here of a community space as well. So that's, I guess, somewhat undefined, but primarily
CrossFit Brook is focused on, you know, more learning space for the student body around 7th and 8th graders and attendant community space or assembly type space around that to, again, really broaden the opportunity inside the school and, you know, make sure that there that additional space comes along with the additional student body.
And when we look, Tim, at the $60 million proposal, the bond issue, when the board kind of had a, maybe you didn't do this, did you have like a total wish list? And are there things that were left out of what the $60 million will pay for?
No, I believe this really is all in. And I think, you know, some of the other accoutrements that we've talked about at CrossFit Brook were sort of late additions as the proposal fully evolved and our administrators worked and some of our board members worked over the summer as to what's going to be the best learning environment over there. So I think that's been settled on at CrossFit Brook in our proposal, and I believe everything else that we've talked about around the high school has been folded into this proposal for the communities.
All right. Tari Smith.
There were times in the past when the wish list was a little longer at the high school. So I think what would happen is, you know, a wish list would come to the board and the board would sort of say, yeah, that doesn't feel like something our community is going to support, and mm-hmm. sort of go back to the drawing board. So the plan that we're looking at now, I think, is it's not bare bones, but it's not luxurious. It's really a strategic thinking about how do we use, you know, limited dollars from our community, because we can't just ask for a blank check. How do we use that to the best of our ability to improve the school?
Well, and
I also was able to find those enrollment numbers.
Go ahead. Why don't you tell us those?
Oh, sure. So I'm just looking at the enrollment numbers for the whole district for the last 5 years. And over the last 5 years, our enrollment has gone down by about 5%. It's a tricky thing. That works out to be about, you know, a little less than 20 kids a year. So our current enrollment as of, you know, early September of this year was 1,630 students in our K-12 program. What happens if you think about, you know, losing 18 kids a year or whatever, that's one or two kids from each elementary school. And then it's, you know, five or six kids or eight kids or something from the high schools the high school is currently a 7-12 program. So the challenge for us as a district is that when you lose one or two kids in an elementary school, you don't just drop a teacher, right? Every other class is still the same. So this is a challenge that we've had to, like, how do we kind of keep things right-sized? And we have been working to manage that and to think that through. The other thing I'd just like people in the community to understand is what we're seeing in our district is happening throughout our Central Vermont region, throughout most of our state. If you're not in Tiverton County, then to a large degree, you're not seeing much growth.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's actually happening even throughout New England and throughout much of rural, you know, United States. We're seeing, you know, what would be the opposite of a baby boom? It'd be sort of an implosion. I mean, we just are not having children as often as we used to. And so that is trickling into our school district. And it affects us not just because of, you know, not having as many bodies in the school, but because of the way the state's funding formula works, it is very tied to student numbers. So mm-hmm. that's one of the reasons we do pay very close attention to our student enrollment. That being said, we don't have, you know, schools that are half empty. We have schools that are being fully utilized, and we are trying to continue to offer diverse programming so that children in our district will have, you know, a competitive standard, you know, excellent education and not just be limited by the somewhat rural nature of where we live.
All right. Let's go to the phones. We've got Freddie joining us from Faceton. Hi, Freddie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions for you folks. One is, what materials you're planning on for the construction.
Oh, Freddie, you're breaking up. Can you repeat the question again, Freddie?
One is the materials being used for the construction.
Mm-hmm.
And and the finishes. When the addition was done at Harwood, the materials were, in my opinion, subpar, and they have not held up well. We're the original school. There are slate sills in the windows, and after being on the board and knowing how maintenance is neglected and schools being torn, we wouldn't have windows if it weren't for those slate sills. And I'd like to be sure that we're using premium product.
Okay.
So that we have longevity. And the other question is, as far as staffing goes, at the high school level in particular, I was on the board for years and asked this question and was unable to ever get the answer. And that is, every teacher, every period, how many students are they teaching? Because that is 85 to 87% of your budget. And if you don't evaluate that, you don't know if you are staffing adequately or inadequately. And I think that that's imperative for the board to look at.
All right, Freddie.
And I will hang up and listen on the radio so I don't keep breaking up.
All right, I appreciate that. Thanks, Freddie. Okay, so the questions Freddie would like to know, some questions about materials being used and finishes, making sure they aren't subpar, and what, you know, what is being budgeted for there, and then how do we make sure that the high school in particular is adequately staffed. Who would like to take question one about materials?
I'll take that on.
Okay.
Sorry. And thank you, Freddie. Nice to hear from you. And I would say, yeah, I think we'll, once, you know, we get into those individual line items and, you know, look at, you know, what we're approved to do, I think we'll have a little bit better of idea of, you know, premium level of materials, you know, versus, you know, the crooked 2x4, I guess, is sort of the, just a, of the question. And I think, you know, again, this investment is being well planned. We do have professionals giving us that advice in terms of, you know, the bricks and mortar side of the facility renovation. So I think that's a story to be told, but certainly at this level of investment, I want to assure the community that we have an eye on quality and longevity. So I think we're all looking forward to getting into that level of detail as things progress, if we are blessed with an approval from the community here.
And then Tari, Freddie, also concerned about the staffing levels at the high school, never was able to get an answer when she was on the school board. So how do you ensure that the right number of people are at the high school on the staff there?
It's such a great question, and I don't think I'm going to satisfy Freddie today, but I'm going to try to acknowledge it and talk about that a little bit. So the way that, you know, budgeting works is each year the principals in the buildings basically look at their whole program of offerings. They look at their class sizes. They look at how many different classes each teacher is teaching. And the other thing they look at is which students are in the buildings. Are these students who need small class sizes because they need extra, you know, special education support? Are they students who need to have access to a more challenging curriculum than we've currently been offering? And then they work with the teachers to develop a sort of roster of programs to offer to students. The board then takes, and then the principals put together that estimate of what that's going to cost. And the board will sort of say, okay, that seems like too much. That seems like too little, and we sort of haggle back and forth a little. But the board does not get directly involved in those class size discussions at that level. There are statewide policies that guide class size, and if I recall correctly, for the high school, it's that teachers will not have more than 100 students in their course load for the year. So that is one of the guidelines that we use. I will say, you know, we've had some transition in leadership in the last couple of years in the high school, and we're seeing some really exciting stuff happen there. And between the proficiency-based learning, which has really changed the way teachers are thinking about not just their teaching, but also their evaluation and the expectations they have for students, we're just seeing some really exciting stuff happen there. We have two new principals who are it's their second year who have been, you know, bringing some great new energy to the building. So
I think, you know, we're really excited about what's happening in the high school. And we know that it will be even more exciting if the high school can be operating in a building that feels like something out of the 2020s and not the 1960s.
So, Tim, I'm going to start with you. This is going to cost taxpayers in the district additional money. So how will it impact property taxes and over what length of time?
Well, I believe the bond period is a 20-year commitment, I think, is what we're looking at, you know, based on our professional advice from our district CFO. And the last board meeting, Atari and our CFO, Michelle Baker, put together a piece on what we believe the impacts will be, you know, and tying it back to sort of one of those primary concerns of, you know, what's the value of your real estate and, you know, what's the apportionment of tax increase you would see based on that value. I think, and I'll punt a little bit to Tari here as well. We're still working on formulating, this answer, but I guess that's sort of the way where, you know, the tack we're taking is, you know, assigning it to, you know, real estate value as sort of a, you know, the simple approach of saying, you know, if your house is valued at this based on the amount of borrowing, you know, this is what you could expect the impact to be, you know, over 20 years. And then I'll let Tari kind of expound on that a little bit.
Okay.
More immersed.
Yeah, we have been trying to figure out how to translate this from a very abstract idea of $60 million into, you know, each household's pocketbook.
Yep.
So we, based on the cost that we'd have to pay back every year on average, and then the savings that will be possible because of some of the changes that will be able to happen after the bond, we think that this will increase property taxes by about 14 cents. And the way that sort of will translate to property taxes themselves, like your actual bill, on a $250,000 house, that would be an increase of about $362, so a little less than $400. On a $350,000 house, that would be about $500. And on a $500,000 house, that'd be about $725.
Okay.
The other thing that we've been trying to understand a little bit more is about how this will affect homeowners who pay income-sensitized property taxes, because that's actually about two-thirds of Vermonters and in our community. This is a trickier thing to get into because when I was speaking with someone at the tax department, they said, you know, the Vermont tax code is the most complicated in the world.
Yes.
So the general thing to sort of guide you if you're one of those homeowners and trying to understand how this will affect you is that it will probably increase the net taxes that you pay by about 8%.
Okay.
And that's the raise that we saw earlier. So if you make, you know, if you make $80,000 and you have a $350,000 house, right now, instead of paying almost $6,000, you would pay a little over $2,000. So your tax increase would go up by 8% of $2,000. Now, the more money that you make closer to that threshold for the income sensitized class tax, the closer you'll get to that total increase that I started with, which was, remember, it was about $350 for a $250,000 home, $500 for a $350,000 home, and $725 for a $500,000 home.
All right. Let's not get too far into the weeds on that. Is something people can look up individually. I do want to talk about PCBs because I mentioned it at the beginning, Burlington High School. So has the district tested for PCBs? What's the timetable? And how does that work, Tari, with this, if the bond is approved, you know, with the project at the high school?
This one I'm going to punt back to Tim because he has been sort of taking the lead on that.
Great. Thanks.
I think, again, you know, Burlington is sort of obviously on everyone's mind. And, you know, not being present in that situation, all we can do is learn from, you know, what could we have known differently any sooner. And so I think the proposition that's on the table for the board is we do want to proceed with testing. Certainly this bulk testing around, you know, where we're going to be renovating the school and what that would mean in terms of, you know, remediating anything that we did find, versus, you know, doing this air sampling that, the state of Vermont is going to roll out a program around. So at this point, I think we are inviting our experts to our October 13th board meeting, a consultant that's been, has given us a proposal, to ask a few more questions, detailed questions about, you know, how soon is soon enough to get into this. So if the bond is not successful, it's certainly something that we're going to get into, much like all of these other items that have been deferred. So I think we're just trying to measure, you know, how much we invest right now to know more than we know versus the carry or the contingency that we're carrying in our budget for the bond that says, you know, based on a similar school, I think Williston is the model in this case, based on a similar scope of project, you know, what did they encounter, you know, same vintage of building and so forth. So right now we're looking at that contingency carry, and if we need to, we'll make some adjustments to that. So that'll be happening over the next couple of weeks.
Okay. Tari, we have just 2 minutes left. I have this question from Lisa Scalotti from the Waterbury Roundabout, and she says Waterbury is the largest town in the district, and it notoriously takes multiple votes to approve big spending requests. She goes on to mention a few of them, but how will you convince Waterbury voters to support this at the level that is needed?
Well, we're trying. So, you know, we're trying to create materials that explain the need and also the cost to voters. We're trying to meet with groups. We're organizing Q&As. You know, one good thing about COVID is we've learned how easy it is to have certain meetings like a Q&A type of thing online. And that's pretty easy to join, you know, from your house. You don't even have to get in your car. You can make dinner while you're listening in. And then we'll also have all those things available afterwards to be reviewed afterwards if you couldn't make that time. So we're really just trying to get the word out about what this project offers our community and then how it would affect individual households in terms of cost. And we hope that on November 2nd, you know, the majority of voters will support the proposal.
And how can people learn about further opportunities to learn about the bond proposal?
The easiest thing to do right now is to send them to our school district's website, which is huusd.org. And we will be, over the next week or so, really boosting the sort of information there. We'll have plans, we'll have a video, we'll have FAQs. So we've been, you know, scrambling to put all this together. We had to sort of wait till we figured out what was approved before we could figure out how to promote it all. So,
all right. That's Tari Smith. She is the Harwood Unified Union School District Chair. Tim Smith, now I've got the names wrong, don't I? Tim Jones is the vice chair of the board. I got Smith and Jones. Listeners, again, to learn about the bond proposal, you can visit huusd.org. Tari, Tim, I really appreciate you giving us this full hour this morning to try to understand this plan. Very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us on.
All right. Take care. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint, directed by Danny McGivergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Love to hear from you to suggest topics or guests. And you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The Vermont Viewpoint podcast is sponsored by the Warren Store, funky, friendly, and almost world famous. Common Sense Radio up next with Bill Sayre. And then at noon after the news, we've got the governor's COVID-19 response news conference. That is at about 12:05. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.